we offer something a bit different for this series of podcasts. Life Between the Vines visited Chicago last month for the Alsace Rocks event. There's not enough great things you can say about these fantastic wines. So here we offer interviews with four winemakers growing each of their family legacies in wine. In fact, they do rock Alsace. And welcome to podcast number 339, the fourth interview from Alsace Rocks, featuring Jean-Frédéric Hugel of Famille Hugel. You can watch a video of the interview on our YouTube channel. Continuing with Alsace Rocks, I am here with Jean-Frédéric Hugel.
Yes.
Of Famille Hugel Winery.
Perfect.
Which is obviously in Alsace. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Welcome to Chicago. Have you been here before?
I have been here before a couple of times.
How easily available are your wines in this area or around the country?
Fairly decently available. We're distributed across pretty much all states. I think Alaska is an exception. But you should be able to find them if you're looking for them.
Yeah, I was going to make a joke that Alaskans drink ice wine. Sorry. it's just a bad joke and not anything. About how much of your production are you exporting to the States?
More or less 15%.
Okay.
So, yes, 10,000 cases.
So the one thing I talked about briefly here, commonalities, your family's winery has been around for how long now?
380 years.
That's pretty amazing to think about that history, isn't it?
And pretty breathtaking when you're thinking of every generation, every step, and how lucky we are to be still in business, especially in a troubled area like Alsace.
You yourself, are you the winemaker, or are you, what is your position?
I'm on the dark side of the job.
Sales.
I'm in charge of sales.
I figured that out.
In the family, we try to split tasks in the way that you don't want to be stepping on each other's foot. We're a family company. You have to be able to work with the family, and that means that in the end we trust each other when it comes to everyday management, but then all the big decisions are taken unanimously.
Have you taken the time, or are you ever invited to be involved in the cellar, just so you have that background, that knowledge?
Well, that's the thing about being a family company. You have to be able to touch at every aspect of the company. So, for example, I have many calls from my importers across the globe that tell me that they need me in September, and I say, sorry, September, I can't. It's harvest time.
So you're out there working too?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's got to be a lot of fun, though. I mean, it's backbreaking, it's hard work, but it's still got to be fun compared to what
I have a little wording issue when I talk about harvest. And the two words in French are actually fairly close. So when I talk about harvest, I generally call it vacation, which... So we're getting ready for vacation? Vacation, it's harvest coming. Oh, yes, no, sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, everybody's thinking you're out there really killing yourself, but you're really enjoying it.
It's like all seasonal things, you know? You're looking forward to it before it, and you're fed up with it at the end.
Yeah, it's so funny how many times I've heard that. Is the start is you're fresh, you're
absolutely
right.
And you're so excited about it, and then at the end your back hurts, your feet hurts, everything hurts, and you go, I wonder how I did it again, and I'm not sure I can do it next year.
How many harvests have you done personally? Do you remember?
First one was 2009. And then depending on school schedules, you know, school starts fairly late in France. I had a few years at school that started off fairly late. So in the early harvest, I've been able to be around. And then since 2013, every single one.
Is there a part of the harvest that you look forward to the most?
The end. No, the best part of harvest, it's probably when we pick the late harvest wines, because this is never a given, you know? The dry wines, whatever happens, you're going to bring the grapes in. When it comes to late harvest wines, you're just hoping that everything goes according to the plan, and then at the end, you look at the results and you go, we have some botrytis. Tomorrow's going to be a good day. So you rub your hands and you go, tomorrow is the big day. Despite harvest, despite the exhaustion, tough time to sleep the day before picking late harvest.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, and then on top of that, you're dealing with weather issues that might or might not make your life pure hell.
But as my great uncle said, weather is only a conversation topic. There's nothing you can do about it, so you can talk about it, but in the end, you're just looking at the sky and it falls on you like on everyone.
Yeah, that's well said. I like that. So in Alsace, what kind of a climate are you dealing with there, for starters?
Semi-continental, they call it. So generally speaking, fairly dry. It's the driest wine region of France. always good to be reminded, because I have a lot of friends who I made in other regions and other wine regions that it doesn't connect, because you're far north, they expect a lot of rain, so they say it's always rainy at your place. No, it's actually really, really dry. And then still hot days, cool nights, hot summers, cold winters, so very, very noticeable seasons, very, very strong season.
When you're talking about wine, I mean, today was a good example. You know, you had this panel, which, by the way, was excellent. You guys did a great job.
Thank you.
Very educational, very smart. A couple of questions that might have been a little debatable from some people, which...
Possibly. Everything's debatable. It's about wine and taste and palates. Yeah. So,
you know, in the end, what you're doing is wine education. Of course, you're trying to get people to understand how wonderful these wines are. And the old ones were amazing, by the way. What do you find your greatest challenge, though, when you're trying to explain to somebody, hey, oh, I only drink red, or, you know, oh, it's a sweet wine. You talked about that. You know, how do you deal with that?
The biggest challenge I have is that I only have 24 hours a day and 365 days a year. That's the main challenge, because once you put it in people's glass, once you put it in people's mouth, you'll see a smile. You will every single time see a smile. We have a diversity of grapes. We have a diversity of profiles of wines, of styles of wines that will convert anyone.
I agree with that. And I'll go back to it. Was yours the 76, if I remember correctly?
Mm-hmm.
That literally did knock my socks off. It was so beautiful. It was fresh, crisp.
It's a baby wine.
Incredible.
The common denominator of all great wines is their ability to age. And Alsace proves that better than any other wine region in the world. The oldest wine in the world is an Alsace wine. It's from the 1400s. It's in a barrel in the Hospice de Strasbourg.
I did not know that. Has that been... in any way, shape, or form tasted at this point, or?
The General Leclerc, who liberated Strasbourg, tasted it in 45.
Wow.
Seemed very happy about it.
Yeah. But even 1976 for a white, to the average American, their eyes would bug out and say that's not possible.
To the average French, too.
Yeah, really. That's a fact.
Of course, of course. And that's what we have to fight against, you know, getting people to drink their wines when they're ready. And unfortunately, too few people have a cellar, the occasion, the opportunity to age wines. That's why, you know, at Hugel, for example, what we're releasing at the moment out of our great vineyards and great locations is 2011, it's 2012, because we give them the proper amount of bottle aging before release.
Now, we were talking a couple of the other wineries using only stainless steel. Are you going beyond that, or is that strictly what you use as well, or do you go to Clamphora? What do you do?
The one thing that we do at the winery is that we do not throw the baby with the bathwater. So, in Alsace, people have been using oak vessels for the past centuries. You know, by the way, it's the Gauls that invented the barrel. The Romans were using amphoras. So, that's the French addition to winemaking. In the past centuries, since the year 50 or since the year 100, people have been using barrels and food and big casks, and so we still do, you know.
Sure.
When I explain it to people, why do you still keep them? Because they're paid for and they're here, you know. why would they're still running. Why would I move them to put something else that's going to be more expensive to bring in, that's going to be more of a hustle to get through the elevator, because everything at the winery needs to go through the elevator. We're still in the center of town, so we still space is the main commodity that we're scarce on. So yes, that we use today at the winery about one third of old oak food, one third of concrete, one third of stainless. And, you know, probably if we were building a brand new winery outside of town and building a brand new location, we would probably go 100% stainless, because it's easier. We still have these beautiful oak casks, some of them, 20 of them, that were made by family members. So there's on top of the paid for aspect,
sure,
there's a particular relationship to them, because they are, you know, there's a lot about wine that talks time. Wine is the only way we can get in touch with the past. I've personally been able, that 76 was made by my great uncle, who now passed away. I hope my children will have a chance to taste that wine, so I can tell them who made this wine. And I had opportunities to taste wines that were made by my great-great-grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather that I've never met. So it's the only thing that connects us. It's the wines they produce.
That's a good way of putting it. Well, and I've often said, and many times in this podcast, that winemakers are unique in that there's no other business where you live in the past, you live in the present, and you live in the future simultaneously.
Absolutely.
And back to your point of putting a lot on your shoulders, as well as what you have to plan for, as in also making sure what you're dealing with today.
What's happening today is fairly easy for me. I'm just coming, I'm just arriving, I'm in a new generation. So you don't judge a winemaker on what's happening today. You judge him on what's happening in 20 years. If he's done a good job, the wines that he's made today will be to drink in 20 years.
Right, exactly. Yeah, good answer. So now I'm going to corner you with a tough question, or at least what's turned out to be a tough question. And that is, for the period of time you've been in this business, and I'm sure you've talked to plenty of people in the press, and certainly these seminars where people ask you questions, what's the one question that you haven't been asked that you would like to be asked?
Wow. That is a tough question. I think it's very closely linked to acidity. This is very often a misconception that I see, you know. Oh, this has great acidity, this is gonna age a long time. And I think the question would be, how does acidity relate to aging, and how does it help with aging? Because people assume high acidity wines will age a long, long time. Yes, but if it's underripe, it's going to have very high acidity and it's not going to age. So the 76 that we tasted today is a very good example. Very soft acidity,
very
extremely
soft.
It's a super hot vintage, it's a heat wave vintage, very low acid. The wines age fabulously well, absolutely fabulously well. So some vintages will age despite the lack of acidity.
You yourself, before you really got into the business, I mean, was it your intent to be in the wine business, or were you thinking otherwise?
I first wanted to be a marine biologist. So I have a second passion. I have two very expensive passions. One of them being wine, of course, and the second one being fishing and waters, more generally speaking. You know, I have an ex-girlfriend who told me, I know how you will die. You will die drowning in a river, because every time you see water, you can't resist it. You have to go closer. So that was an intention as well. That was a possibility as well.
But the pull of wine was greater.
It grows on you. Probably when you're 15 or 16, you don't realize how rich of a field it can be, even though you're from a wine family. So it's really over time, over years, that you know, you're tasting a few milestone wines in your drinking experiences, and you go, wow, that's actually pretty good, and that's causing emotions. That's actually causing something. And then very much what I saw, what made me attracted in wine, was that I saw it in other people's eyes as well. You know, opening bottles like 76 and people getting really, really excited about it. And I went, huh, I get to do that every, well, 76 maybe not every day, but I get to do that every day. And that still means a lot to some people. There must be something about it. And so you start to investigate, and then one day you find yourself, you know, someone telling you, wow, I didn't know it would cause so much emotion to you. And you go, huh, and I just went on the other side of the mirror now.
Kind of funny, isn't it? Mm. Hmm. So when you talk to people, especially because you're in sales, and I'm sure you get very frustrated by the idea of having to explain to people what Alsace is, which is an incredible wine area, but also this idea of, well, I only drink red.
That gets me excited.
How so?
Well,
is it a challenge?
What happens very often is I only drink red until I tasted Gewürztraminer, because that's my converter. You know, when I meet people, I only drink red. They like bold, fleshy, powerful wines. Gewürztraminer has all of that. They don't like high acidity on whites. Gewürztraminer has that. So I like that challenge. I I like to say that this is probably the only thing that keeps me at a job, you know. I'm the salesperson for the family. If we sell everything without having to work, what? I'm fired. I'm not useful anymore. So
yeah,
no, that's I like challenges. I really personally like challenges, especially when I can succeed. So, you can't be frustrated with that. I mean, people that only drink red will probably, you know, maybe only once or twice in their life have an opportunity to taste a white wine that they like. So if you can make that happen yourself, you probably change someone's life.
You coined a great word, and that is converter. It was your converter demeanor. I'm not sure people think of things that way, but it's a great way to put it, a convenient way of putting it.
As soon as you find one white wine, one of your wines that someone likes, they do not only drink red wines anymore.
True.
So they're converted. They can't say it anymore.
Do you have a tasting room at the winery?
Of course.
And is that something that people should contact you by the website? Is it
by website, by phone, by social media? Don't hesitate. Really, don't hesitate. We're in the center of Lakeview, one of the most picturesque towns in the world. My great uncle used to call it the center of the world. Because the winery is literally the center of the world. You know, we're at the center of Lakeview, which is in the center of Alsace. Alsace is in the center of Europe, and Europe was the center of the world in the Middle Ages. So we're at the center of the world. Don't miss it. Come and visit us.
No, I'd love to. And your website for our listeners?
Hugel.com. H-U-G-E-L.
That's what I wanted to hear. Jean-Frédéric, thank you very much for taking the time to come to the States and to come up here. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Learn more by visiting Hugel.com.
Listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.